You're now listening to Sound Talent Media. Check out more shows at soundtalentmedia.com.
We got another day of NBA action. And with FanDuel, every night is a watch party. So it's time for your FanDuel crew to make their bets. So, what's the move tonight, gang? You know the new customers who bet $5 get $150 back in bonus bets? Woohoo! We're heating up, fam! Bet all the stars with all your friends and make every moment more, only on FanDuel. New customers bet $5, get $150 back in bonus bets. Make every moment more with FanDuel, America's number one sports book.
It goes down in the DM. It go down in the DM.
21 plus and present in Ohio. First online real money wager only. $10 first deposit required. Bonus issued is non-withdrawable bonus bets that expire 7 days after receipt. See full terms at FanDuel.com/sportsbook. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER.
Hello, and welcome to episode number 6 of That One Time on Tour. As always, I'm your host, Chris Swinney. I'd like to thank everybody for checking out last week's episode with my friend Eddie from Taking Back Sunday, and thank you very much for checking out the past episodes as well. I'd like to thank my friends in the Philippines and New Zealand and Singapore for checking out the show. I'm kind of running a tally of all the different countries that are checking out the show, so it's really cool when we get a new country. We got 3 new countries this time. So thank you very much. I would like to address that I've been getting some emails from people wanting to sponsor a show or run some ads on the show. I wasn't really prepared for that, but I'm into it. So this show does cost some money to keep going as far as, you know, hosting the actual audio files and whatnot. And I had to buy some equipment. So if you would like to help me keep the lights on, you'd like to sponsor a show or, you know, advertise a product that I feel I want to advertise, hit me up at TOTOTpodcast@gmail.com, or you can hit me up at any of the social media platforms at TOTOTpodcast. So this week on the show, episode 6, I get to have a conversation with a very, very special person to me, a big influence as far as music goes. I get to talk to Kira Rossler, ex-bass player for Black Flag. Black Flag was a big deal for me. They're one of my bands that I just, like, probably top 5 to 7 bands. I like a lot of bands, so it's hard for me to pick. But the work ethic of Black Flag, just everything, the like ferocity of Black Flag, the intensity, like they're one of those bands. And they kind of blazed a trail for bands after them as far as DIY touring and just kind of doing it yourself, you know, like putting out your own records and just doing everything. So I'm very, very honored to have had this chance to speak with Kira, and she was great. We had such a good time, or at least I know I had a good time speaking with her. I hope that the feeling is mutual. But so here it is. I won't say any more stuff. I'll get right into it. Thank you guys for coming back, letting me be a part of your life. This thing is a lot of fun, and I cannot wait for you to hear this. So without further ado, here it is, my conversation with Kira Rossler of Black Flag. Hey, Kira, what's going on?
Hello there. How are you?
I'm doing great. It's nice to speak with you. It's an honor to have you on the show. I really appreciate it.
Well, it's an honor to be on your show, young man.
Well, thank you very much. I'm not that young.
How old are you?
I am 39. I will be 40 in October. So,
well, I will be 57 in June, just to keep it honest.
57 years young, I will say.
We'll see about that. We'll see how far I get.
Well, I'm very excited to have you on the show. This is That One Time on Tour. We talk about being on the road, but we also talk about, you know, everything else. So I kind of want to go back to One thing that I saw when I was researching you a little bit that I didn't know prior was that we kind of share something. You spent some time growing up in the Caribbean. Is that true?
That's absolutely true. When I was 8 years old till 11.
Yeah, that's awesome. My wife and I and my son, right after my son was born a few years ago, I took a job in Montego Bay, Jamaica, and we were there for a while, and it was quite a change.
Yeah, I was in Curaçao, which is off the coast of Venezuela, Dutch island, run, you know, Dutch government, Dutch schools. One a wonderful experience for a kid, you know, to just experience a different culture, because I think Americans especially just aren't exposed to other cultures. So we have a sort of skewed idea of the importance of our culture.
Yeah. I think there's some kind of percentage that I've seen that only 12% of Americans have passports. And I think that needs to go up quite a bit.
Well, or something, or a willingness to, you know, open your eyes and ears to the rest of the world. Anyway, I think that that really affected me as a kid. And I think as a kid, you're much more able to absorb a language or a culture or an idea, you know?
Yeah, definitely. I think it does broaden your horizons. I mean, even just to, you know, to go on vacation somewhere, but to actually live somewhere and kind of immerse yourself in the culture, which when I was in Jamaica, I'd been there before, like on vacation with my parents and whatnot, but being there and actually living there and driving on the other side of the road and just doing all the things and meeting all the people, it really does kind of change your worldview. And I really like that about travel, and especially living somewhere different.
Yeah, definitely. Vacationing is a completely different thing.
Yeah, I've always I've been to close to 60 countries. I mean, that's through playing music and doing other things. But I always try to not be a quote unquote tourist. I try to be a traveler.
Yeah,
because I like to, you know, I've even been on cruise ships before where we'll get to the port, and I freaked my mother out because we were in Cozumel, Mexico. And she said, "Well, what are we going to do?" I said, "We're just going to get a taxi and go see what we're going to do." And she was a little scared, but I think we had a much better experience because we weren't just, you know, going to the whatever the cruise ship told us to go do. We actually left the terminal and went out and explored. So
yeah, right.
I think it's really great when people can do that. But so that was just something I was very interested in, because not a lot of people have lived in the Caribbean, and it's something that we share. So thank you very much for telling me about that.
Sure.
So one thing I'm very interested in, I've always been a huge fan of kind of the early, the, like the 80s punk hardcore movement with, you know, the DIY tour circuit and everything, especially SST Records and Black Flag and different bands. How was it for you? And I'm sure you've probably spoken this at length in other interviews, but how was it for you being, you know, a female and kind of a male dominated genre, a male dominated kind of scene? Was that, did you find it to be, I mean, and you might not have even thought about it at the time, but did it feel kind of different to you, or did you feel like you were kind of carrying the torch a little bit, or am I totally off?
Well, in a way, yes, you're totally off, because in the late 70s, early 80s, the punk rock scene and Hollywood stuff was, you know, lots of women involved in early punk rock, or get women in bands, you know, bass players, singers, you know, plenty of that. I swear the early fanzines, that women were on the cover, they were setting the fashion trends, you know, and that they were famous, like just for being like cool looking and cool, you know. So there was always this sense of a female presence to me. So that's one factor. The other is I'm a total tomboy, so I don't feel that female at the time. And you know, in the sense that I was always a little more comfortable hanging with the guys, playing football, you know, tossing around the football, you know, whatever. So it was never a girly girl ever in my life. So with those two things in mind, get it going on tour. Well, when I joined Black Flag, they were my favorite band.
Wow.
And one of the reasons they were my favorite band is because they were so all in. in the sense they were traveling. They were, you know, giving it, you know, sort of 10,000%, where a lot of bands were just, you know, hanging around LA, you know, playing and working jobs or whatever, you know, which is fine, but they stood out that way, you know. So when the opportunity came for me to join, that was pretty special. So I was more focused, I'll just say, in terms of, you know, being a good band member, whatever that meant. And of course, that meant touring, and I understood that meant touring. So there was never any sort of, how is that going to work with me, you know, being different than them, having different body parts or whatever, you know what I mean? That was that mechanical aspect just didn't. Now, of course, there were things about it that made it complicated, but that wasn't a consideration going in for sure.
Was that your, when you joined Black Flag, like, can you kind of take me back to, I mean, I know Chuck was the bass player originally. Can you take me back to my research that I was doing on you? You're going to UCLA, correct?
Yes. I was 3 years into my, UCLA degree, and, I was playing with Dez and another guy in a band called DC3, and it was a power trio. And we were practicing at the same place as Black Flag was. And actually Henry called me and he said, you know, Chuck's gone. Do you want to jam with Bill and Greg? And I was like, well, yeah. And he's like, well, stay after practice. Because we had a schedule, you know, because we practiced and they practiced. So we all had a schedule. Just a sec. So I stayed after. And it seemed very much like they didn't know that this was planned, because I was like, so you want to jam? And I'm like, okay.
So Henry kind of springed it on him a little bit.
It seemed like it. Now, I mean, they had seen me play in other bands in LA. I mean, it was not like they didn't know who I was or that I was a good bass player or anything. It's not like, you know, they knew I played with Dez, you know, so there was no mystery about me, but I'm not sure whether it wasn't Henry's idea to give it a try. It seemed like it when they seemed surprised. Now, maybe they had just, well, we didn't know we were doing it tonight or whatever. But anyway, so I jammed with them for a long time. It felt like a long time because I'd already played and it kicked my butt. And by at the end of it, they said, well, do you want to join Black Flag? And I said, yeah, but I want to finish college. We talked a little bit about, you know, how we were going to tour and, you know, I was going to take quarters off, but, you know, sort of still keep plugging away at my degree. So that night it was all settled.
Well, that's really cool. It's pretty cool to get to join your favorite band. I mean, so you'd actually been like seeing them at gigs in California and.
Since the early days. I saw Keith. I saw Ron. I was a big fan of theirs. I wouldn't say they were my favorite. The favorite gig of that I saw was with Henry and Biscuits, you know, the five piece with Dez. That was the first time I went like, holy shit, you know, this is way cool. Although Bill is now my favorite drummer.
Yeah.
At that time, that lineup was pretty amazing.
Were you kind of immersed in the scene then as well? I know you were playing in bands. I mean, did you see the Descendants when Bill was playing with them? I mean, were there other bands that really...
Yeah, I mean, from when I was 16, I was a punk rocker.
That's great.
So by the time we're talking about of me seeing Henry and them at the Whiskey with Biscuits, I am in my 20s. I've been playing around LA for years, seeing bands, you know, going to school. I mean, I was in high school. I was in 11th grade. So seeing bands, going to school, playing, you know, practicing, basically just go to school in the morning, practice in the afternoon, go to see gigs at night every day.
It sounds like a pretty good life.
it has its drawbacks, but yes, it did. I did I still was careful to do well in school because I had to deal with my mom, and she didn't live, we didn't live with my mom. So I had, it made things complicated because I could do things like drink and stay out late, which, you know, maybe other 16-year-olds wouldn't have been able to pull off. But I went to school, I got good grades, and the focus on playing, not just going to gigs, but, you know, practicing and playing and stuff kept me somewhat focused too.
What was bass your first choice? I mean, what got you into actually wanting to learn an instrument? Was it pretty early on in your life?
I started piano at 6. I played classical piano from 6 to 11. I quit because I couldn't keep up with my brother, who's 3 years older than me. And then 3 years later, when I was 14, he was in a prog rock band and his bass player quit.
Okay.
And so the singer started playing bass as well, but I borrowed a bass and started practicing every day, like a lot of hours, like 6 hours a day, trying to get good enough to be in my brother's prog rock band.
What was the name what was the name of the prog rock band your brother had?
Arc Squared.
Okay.
ARC, Arc Squared. Yeah. So yeah, I practiced really hard, and then, you know, by the time I was 16, he was had gotten out of prog rock and was into punk rock, and I didn't have to be as good, and so it all worked out, and we had our first punk rock band when I was 16.
Well, I think, do you think that maybe trying to achieve, you know, being in the prog rock band, I'm sure you were probably going through your scales and maybe doing some theory and whatnot. Do you think that made you a better bass player down the road?
Absolutely. Well, all of it. I studied jazz with a teacher. I studied classical. As you say, when I was practicing those 6 hours alone in my room, I was doing everything. I was playing along to the prog rock music. I was also doing scales and theory and reading, sight reading and everything. I once tried out for the Mystic Knights of Oingo Boingo that turned into Oingo Boingo, which did all sight reading. But they wanted me to wear the stupid outfit, which they wore. Anyway, long story. But yeah, of course. I mean, to my mind, and this is, you know, hindsight, one of the important things about an instrument like bass is it's physically pretty demanding. So if you have to kind of push past the part where your hands don't want to do that, they don't want to do what you're telling it to. So there's sort of the physical part, and then there's the mental part of knowing what the hell you want to do. And the mental part came more slowly. The physical part came more quickly because I just applied a lot of hours to it.
I teach guitar and bass, and actually just started teaching ukulele. That's kind of my job that I have now. It's a full-time gig. And I have way less bass students, but I do have some bass students. And the consensus that I've heard from these kids that are taking bass lessons from me is that, well, I wanted to do bass because it's easier. And then they come to me and I'm like, well, it's not easier at all. You can think of it that way, but there's so much involved if you actually want to, you know, do a good job on the bass. And these kids come in and they're not ready for all the scales and all the theory and all the stuff that I give them. And then they... Yeah. I think it makes you better, though, and I think that's a really cool way to look at it is, you know, you actually put all that time in and actually, you know, honed your craft. And I'm sure that then being in the punk, you know, hardcore world, you were probably kind of an enigma because, I mean, I know even now the guys that I meet that are amazing musicians, they don't really know what they're doing.
No, not necessarily from a theory point of view. You're right. Yeah, I had some students. I struggle with keeping students because my schedule is erratic. But I got into doing group lessons and making them kind of play off each other, which I found helped them understand why. You know, why do I have to sort of keep time in my head, you know, because I have to come in on the third beat or whatever. So I'm like making them count and stuff like that. And that was a big sort of revelation in teaching. It's like, I don't even get that much into theory, but I do get into, you know, you're not playing alone in a room. So, you know, if you want to play with someone else, you have to figure out how is that communication happening? That's what rules are we playing by here?
Definitely. Yeah. I run into the same issue. I've a lot of my guitar students, they like, you know, we'll just sit in their room and play for hours. But my bass students, I think they tend to, if some of them play along to YouTube videos or whatever, but yeah, I do think that if you can get some kids or some even just, you know, adults that are learning instruments in the same room together, I think it does really help that kind of human interaction as well. I mean, minus the theory, just to kind of feel it and kind of develop your ear. You know, I really agree with you there.
Yeah.
Okay. So let's get back to Black Flag.
Okay.
So you joined Black Flag. Did you right away start recording or was there touring involved? What was kind of the next step?
Okay, so we had, they had the My War tour schedule. They had already recorded the record My War, but they had a tour scheduled. And they were in the middle of a lawsuit against Unicorn Records. So they'd just gotten that sort of the injunction lifted so they could start recording. So there was a lot of recording planned as well. So, so like 6 days into playing with them, I hurt my hand, and the doctor said, you know, don't play for 6 weeks. And I was like, yeah, I'm a girl and I just joined Black Flag. I can't do that.
You don't really have the option to do that, right?
I just didn't feel, you know, I'm a tomboy. Maybe if I was, you know, someone else, but I'm like, I can't do that. And they would have, they were totally supportive. They were like, look, Carrie, you got to take care of yourself. You got to do what you got to do. And I was like, now, 4 days later, I was back at practice and my hand's never been the same, but,
really?
But we took off on the My War tour, you know, a few like weeks later, which was my first tour with them.
Was that your first kind of tour experience ever, like being out of California, like actually playing, like, you know, being in
playing,
a van?
Yes, I had gone on an excursion with the Screamers as a roadie, but playing, yes.
How was that? Was it a kind of like a shock to the system? I mean, was it, because I know I've read Al Henry's books and I've kind of the lore of Black Flag, like the touring was, you know, it was pretty brutal at times. And I mean, you know, Dukowski booking dates, not really looking at a map, I think.
Well, yeah, I mean, look, the first tour, sure, it was an eye opener. It was, again, I'm also in the shut up, you're a girl mode, you know, but,
yeah.
But so the first tour they had this great idea. They were going to have this little school bus that we drove and it lasted like 1.5 states. Yeah. So we're in the middle of fucking nowhere and we have a gig to get to and our vehicle breaks down. And Dukowski drives out in his little van and loads up all our gear and us in his van. Now we've taken like a little mini school bus worth of shit and put it into a van. And he drives us to Oklahoma City where we were supposed to have been, you know, hours ago, and people are waiting, but they're pissed.
Yeah.
You know, but we get there and then, you know, so he keeps driving for a while, but you know, so that turns of a fiasco where, you know, we were on top of each other, you know, very tight quarters, no air conditioning, you know, blah-de-blah-de-blah-de-blah.
Yeah.
So aside from the fact that I was physically just absolutely not up to it, I mean, every day I was in tears with my hands in an ice bucket at the end of the show.
Wow.
There's this picture that I've seen since then, and the other guys are standing around me and I'm like on the ground with hanging my head. And it looks like we're in a fight or something, but it's really no doubt that they're waiting for me to collect myself to go do a encore or something, you know, because I was just always in agony on my right hand because I'm an idiot. I'm left-handed and I play right-handed. So I have my weak hand on the hand that once you play with a drummer, you know, you should have your strong hand.
Yeah. Yeah.
So, so that was I was pretty much my main focus was, you know, surviving the gigs. I was blowing out speakers all the time because I couldn't hear myself. So I would hit harder, you know, so it was this cycle of I would hurt my hands because I was hitting. Couldn't hear myself because Greg had as much power as me and he's a guitar player. So he didn't need as much power as me. So I'm blowing out speakers, where I'm going to replace speakers. I mean, it's just, you know, stuff like that. It's like the mechanics.
Yeah. Yeah.
So I'm not necessarily engaged in enjoying the gig with the crowd or, you know, I mean, I'm looking at Bill mostly to just make sure that I'm playing hard and playing right, you know, and that was all that tour was about.
And so after that tour, did you guys do any like international stuff? Cause I mean, I know that, you know, they went to the UK a lot. They did a lot in Europe. Did you ever go over there with them?
Yes. So, I can't remember what order. I think we recorded Slip It In before we went to Europe, or we went to Europe and then we recorded Slip It In. But, we went to England, Holland, Germany, and Sweden.
Okay.
And part of Europe. We're supposed to go with Husker Du. Husker Du flakes out. Everybody's fucking pissed as hell. Henry has long hair. You know, I have the shortest hair in the band. So we have a double whammy. You know, we've got, you know, these long haired hippie dudes and we don't have Husker Du. We have, you know, our roadies band opening for us, you know.
Was that the Nig Heist?
Yeah. Okay. We have Nig Heist.
Okay.
And so that was a little bit of a rough tour. We, you know, there was a certain amount of pushback on the slow songs, the long hair, the no Husker Du. It was sort of a triple thing.
Were there any like crazy things that happened? I mean, I've you know, read some of the Henry's books and whatnot about how, I mean, even in the early days, a lot of like the UK guys would like, you know, throw beer or they'd just tan with their backs to you and flip you off, like stuff like that. Did anything like bad happen on that tour because of all the extenuating circumstances?
Chairs, it was like, okay, folding chairs in Manchester. And like, then it was in Glasgow, they were just spitting at us.
Wow.
So like, I was turning my back to my amp. Greg was behind his amp and Henry just stood up front and took it. And then at the end, we're like loading out and, you know, thinking, fuck these guys, we're not coming back here. And they're all like, yeah, great show. You know, we're like, why were you fucking spitting on us? And it's like, yeah, that's what we do. We like the show. And we're like, yeah, see you in 10 years, asshole. Maybe you'll be over it, you know.
Yeah, I had a beer thrown at me one time at a gig, and the guy's like, punk rock. I'm like, I'm not that punk rock, man. This guitar is expensive.
Rock. Yeah, I mean, I've had to hit people with my bass. I was confronted in England a couple times, like, you bring bombs to our country. You know, like, me and Ron Reagan were, like, making deals with Margaret Thatcher to bring bombs to your country. You know?
That's crazy.
So, you know. So there was, you know, political stuff. There's like, you're not punk enough stuff, you know, and we were playing side two of My War, like the whole thing.
Yeah.
And if anyone doesn't know, side two of My Wars has three long dirge songs.
Yes, it does.
It's like not for the people who want it like fast.
Were the crowds like that in the other European countries, or was that kind of relegated to the UK?
Like, people were like that in America. People were really? Like that everywhere. You wow. know? Yeah. They all thought it was me. Well, a lot of them thought it was me because the transition, the first tour with My War songs was the one with me in it. So somehow, well,
they,
know,
thought it was like
to play.
Your influence on the band.
Yeah, right. Like I wrote those songs.
Yeah. I'm, like I said, in everything that I've ever read or listened to, Greg was kind of, I mean, he's a hardworking guy, but he was kind of in control, correct?
Well, the songwriter usually controls the band, yeah. Right? I mean, usually a band is rarely a true democracy. You know, there's usually a songwriter, and he's usually somewhat in control. Now, I believe, and I don't know this for sure, that when Dukowski was in, who was also writing some songs, that they had more of a partnership, and that even may be why Greg didn't want to play with him anymore, because he wanted more control. I don't know. But yeah, I mean, Greg wanted, you know, pretty much people who would, you know, play the songs the way he wanted them played, and had a big say in like when we would tour and how much we would tour, what we would record, and what songs we would record of his Slip It In record, you know, that we're going to record these songs. And then I was back, you know, when we got back off tour, then I went back to school, and inevitably, you know, I would have a midterm, like the morning after a 2-day lockout, to record two records, you know. So Bill and I would play until we dropped, and then I would be sitting there studying for math midterms, because I studied math in college. So
That's crazy.
Yeah, I mean, it was, and it was nonstop. We were either home practicing and recording, or we were touring.
Well, I think that just compounds, like, you know, the folklore around Black Flag, kind of, like you said, being all or nothing, kind of like the hardest working band ever, in my eyes anyway, just what you're saying.
Well, it's
about...
funny, because I was talking to my brother last night, who has glamorized it a bit, because anyway, we were having this weird conversation, and one of the ways he's glamorized it, which I don't know if I can see this or not, but he feels, and maybe it's true, that the touring circuit in the U.S. was basically established by Black Flag. In other words, tying together all the college towns and the place, the gigs and the promoters and all of that. And I would say it's true that there were, you know, by bringing Black Flag into all these towns and setting up arrangements with all these promoters and stuff, you know, something was started.
I will say that, you know, being a little bit younger, like kind of a generation or two, you know, DIY punk band kind of thing, from you guys, that when I was younger, just getting out of high school, and we did the first tour my band did, I booked it completely with like phone cards and using, you know, I had a Book Your Own Fucking Life is what it was called, like a fanzine, and it had all of the different scenes from across America, and you could call bands, you could call promoters, just call people that would let you play at their house or sleep at their house. And I think that was kind of, you guys were the precursor to that. And before, I mean, that's exactly what you just said is true. I think that Black Flag and certain bands of that era that did that, you know, the Dead Boys or anybody, like the bands that actually went out and toured and kind of made
it possible.
I'm sorry,
the Dead Boys would play like 4 or 5 major cities.
Well, yeah, I know.
I mean, we played, for example, 3 gigs in Louisiana.
Okay. That's pretty crazy.
Just saying, we would do, you know, months and months on the road in the U.S. So the smaller towns where a lot of people weren't going, the college towns,
yeah,
you know, Omaha, Nebraska, good, great college town. A lot of people aren't going there.
Yeah, totally. Yeah.
So that stuff, you know, and I think that was different. And I think that was a way to spread, if you want to say this lore, which I didn't really use the word you did, but I think that college connection happens, and it was the college towns that were always more accepting of us. The big cities were hard. LA was impossible.
Was there like a lot of glam metal and stuff going on at that point, and did any of those fans like just kind of not get it? Or you guys probably weren't trying to get those fans, correct? But that was all kind of happening at the same time in Hollywood, in LA, correct?
It wasn't in LA. The problem was that we were a little too big for clubs, but we were not nearly big enough to play, you know, arenas.
Yeah.
The famous riot when we played with the Ramones is because we played too small of a place. It wasn't a riot. There were just 5,000 people outside that couldn't get in, and the cops got upset.
Yeah, that's pretty,
you know,
crazy.
Which is most LA riots is because there's people hanging around outside and the cops don't like it.
that's true.
You know, it's that simple. It's not because like, oh, you guys are being so bad. It's because kids hanging around outside is a little bit scary.
Yeah, definitely. Did you have a lot of run-ins with the police, like during the band's run when you were in the band?
Yes. I would say that we were lucky while I was in them. They had more before and after, as I understand. I seem to have been a bit of a good luck charm that way.
That's good.
I have that all-American girl look.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Even then, you know, I mean, maybe a little bit taken back when I had my purple hair and lace on. But, you know, I did one tour where I wore all, like, basically all the, did the girly girl thing completely. I wore heels. I wore lace. I did purple hair. And people were like, are you the same Kira?
That's awesome. So you guys were on the road. You went to Europe. You did all this stuff. You recorded Slip It In. What, like, eventually led to kind of the ending of your relationship with the band, or the band itself, I guess?
All right. So, yeah, we did. We recorded Slip It In and Family Man and, you know, a lot more stuff.
Yeah, yeah.
And toured a lot more.
Yeah, yeah.
And then, okay, so we did a big four-month tour in 85. Huge U.S. tour. Like, that was the one where we hit every small town. We hit everything. It was in a lot of ways, you could say it was just too long, you know, okay. because of course, you know, as you well know, a band is like a marriage of four or five people, you know.
Yeah.
And so relationships can be strained, especially if they're under stress, like a situation like that. So, I mean, in a way, I have no idea what happened, because I just found out when I called home, like, we were almost back to L.A., and I called home, and I found out that they were planning their next tour, and it was supposed to be my last quarter at UCLA. So I knew that they were planning to fire me because they were planning a tour. And so I did, I think, two more gigs. We played LA, we played San Diego, and then sure enough, as I knew was coming, they fired me, and that was that. So, I mean, Greg has fired so many people that, so I don't think it was particularly complicated. I'll tell you this, I've been kicked out of a lot of bands, and rarely has it been because of my bass playing.
Okay.
So take that for what you will. I mean, I think that the truth is that, you know, personalities are, you know, I've learned a lot about my personality, and I've grown and I've changed, and I'm sure I, you know, was unpleasant at times, especially on 4 hours of sleep every night, you know, and I'm sure they were frustrated and tired and you know, saw everything through their glasses. I mean Henry's written some terrible things about me, and he's also come back and said basically that he took them all back. So
yeah.
I think that you can have that kind of experience where in that context, in that moment, it seemed completely impossible. And then now looking back at it, it's like, yeah, I can't say why that was so impossible.
Do you still, like, kind of, are you civil with the guys? Do you speak to any of them anymore?
Oh, I'm civil with Bill and Henry.
Not so much the other guys.
Greg, you know, Greg is a little more complicated of a personality. Let's just leave it at that. You know?
Yeah.
So, no, I have not been in touch with him, and that relationship is a lot more complicated.
Okay. Well, I know that you did a band called Dose with Mike Watt, who you were actually married to for a while. Are you guys doing anything with that currently, or is that kind of a project that's been put on the back burner?
Dose was a 30-year band.
Well, yeah, definitely.
So it was a very big, long band, and it hasn't officially disbanded, but we have not been doing anything. Mike is a very busy guy. I don't have the burning desire to play live.
Yeah.
I will always play bass. I always tell people, I've been a bass player longer than I've been a woman. Of course I'm going to play bass.
Yeah, definitely.
You know? And I play bass in my room, and I record stuff, and I have a virtual band with people who I send files around, and we build songs, and you know, I play at 6:30 in the morning, know that no one else wants to play at 6:30 in the morning.
Yeah.
You know, and I work on stuff with my brother who's here, who has a little studio, and you know, so stuff happens. But I won't join anyone's band. And as to what me and Mike, that's a complicated relationship too. And okay. I'd like to, you know, we wanted to record more. I haven't totally eliminated the possibility of recording more. I don't think playing live will happen.
Okay.
There's one other project that I could see doing stuff with, who's a guy who's a stand-up bass player, who's also a two-bass band called Awkward, which is a really cool project that we did like a demo. We haven't done a lot since, but it's something that I could see. We've played live a couple times.
Okay. Well, that's great. So what you're doing now for a career, I mean, you've been doing it for a long time, actually. You're working in film. You're doing dialogue editing, correct?
Dialogue and ADR, yeah.
Okay, cool. So are you, when you're doing that, a lot of people, you know, don't really understand the whole idea of recording audio for bands, let alone for film. Are you just at the computer kind of editing in post, or are you actually at the studio while they're doing the ADR? Like, what does it entail, if you don't mind me asking?
So, yeah, I work in post. And what that means is after all the stuff is shot on set, then it goes into the picture editor guy, and he chops it all up and turns it into some sort of continuous piece of, you know, visual art. And then I get it, and it's all chopped up into, you know, all these different scenes and takes of dialogue. And I have to see what I can, you know, do to make it sound like a cohesive bit of dialogue from all these takes, and smooth it out and fix problems. And then what can't be fixed or what they want to add, we go into the ADR studio and record. We also record things like background voices of the people talking in the background, or whatever, someone talking on the phone, an operator on the phone or whatever. So we do additive voices as well as replacement voices in the studio. And then I'll be there with the director and the actor, you know, helping make that a success. And then I'll edit that, combine it. And then we take it to a big mixing stage, which is as big as a theater.
Wow.
Right. With a big mixing console. And we combine the dialogue and the music and the Foley and the sound effects together, and have the director there telling us to change things and stuff, and we create the final product.
That's a long process. That sounds really cool. Me, like, I'm a recording engineer also. And when I found out, you know, I was doing my research and I found all that out about you, that was very, very intriguing. And I really wanted to ask you also that, you won an Oscar. Your team was an Oscar winning team for Mad Max Fury Road. How was that? I mean, was that just like, you know, not a lot of people win Oscars. That's got to be a pretty cool feeling, right?
Look, it's obviously, I don't have the hardware. It's not my Oscar, but the team, it was an amazing team. And I got to go to Sydney, Australia, and work with the team, with George Miller, who's directed the first Mad Max. He directed the first three and this one. He also directed The Babes, and, you know, so he has this wide range. He also was a doctor for 39 years. He's just an incredible individual at 72 years doing Mad Max Fury Road.
Wow.
And has the energy of a young man and just the vision of a fucking lunatic. and it was just, you know, he was a pleasure. It was a pleasure to bust my ass to try to help make it really special, and to visit Sydney, which I would probably never get to go to otherwise. And then we came back here and mixed with, you know, we had top-notch mixers, and the mixers won, as well as the sound team. The editorial team won, so there's two Oscars for the team. And it is, it's, you know, it was funny that it, the rumor got spread that I want an Academy Award, and I kind of clever. Actually, Henry contacted me. He said, I heard you won an Oscar. I'm like, no, I didn't get an Oscar. But, you know, I mean, I can't, unless I'm a sound supervisor, which I'm not, I can't win an Oscar. I do have two Emmys, which I won because in TV, the whole team does get the hardware.
Okay.
So I have won two Emmys for Game of Thrones, which I worked on season two, and John Adams miniseries. And I'm just finishing a film, which I think is a very possible contender.
Okay. Is there anything else you can tell me about the film, or is it kind of under wraps right now?
Well, the film is, there was recently articles out about the trailer and how the trailer, I guess, played at Comic-Con, and people have just been saying, oh my God, this is going to be huge and Academy Award winning. It is the remake of A Star is Born.
Wow. Okay. I'll have to check that out as soon as I get off the phone with you.
Yeah, I would take a look at what anyway, there's a lot of hype around it. You never know with these things. I think it's really great. You never know. It's not like I have all my hopes up, but I think it's an excellent film. It has really talented people in it. It was a really difficult project, so I put a lot of blood, sweat, and tears into it.
Yeah.
So we'll see. And then now I'm working on a more fun project, and I am, and look, I'm a freelance person. So just the fact that I'm like staying working is, you know, pretty much means my career is going as well as it could go. So I have no complaints. The only complaint is that when I got into this, I thought, hey, I'll have breaks between jobs. I could do music, you know, and the truth is when you get good enough, it's harder to get breaks unless you turn down really exciting opportunities, which is hard to do. So I haven't been getting the breaks I was hoping for. Maybe towards the end of this year, I'll get a bit of a break and get to put a little more time. I put time into music very early in the morning, like I said, because I'm fresh, because by the end of a long day on Pro Tools, working on sound, I just don't have it in me to sit down in front of Pro Tools and do music, or just even to just start making sound. I just want quiet, you know?
Yeah, I'm the same way. I have a 2-year-old son and a 7-month-old daughter, and I used to sleep.
Oh my God.
I used to sleep like all day, and I'd be up all night. I'd get up, go to work, 'cause I taught guitar. But now that, you know, I have kids, I'm up at, you know, fairly early in the morning. So my whole schedule has shifted. So when you told me I could do the morning on Monday, I was like, that's perfect.
Yeah, no, I get up at 5, walk my dogs, you know, maybe a little bass, and then I'm at work by 8, and, you know, and I try to get out of here before 7 o'clock at night.
Yeah.
And, you know, and then maybe there's time for dinner and more dog walking before, you know, I'm too tired to do anything at 57 years old, remember? So, look, I have no complaints. I have no complaints. I just thought I'd be able to manage a little more time off, but these are quality problems.
Very quality problems. And I think that's, I've had you on the phone now for almost 45 minutes, and I try to keep these things around there, and I don't want to take up too much more of your time. So I think we could leave it there. And I just want to tell you that it's been wonderful speaking with you and hearing about your life and everything that you've got going on. Is there anything that you would like to promote maybe, or?
Well, I definitely think you should check out A Star is Born when it comes out in October, I believe. I don't have anything. Unfortunately, listening to music is something also that kind of suffers in my life because of all of the sound work I do. I don't listen to as much music as I might because my ears are just, you know, not. I listen to podcasts a little bit more because I can listen to them kind of quietly. And
the same here. I listen to podcasts pretty much religiously now on my commutes places because I'm around.
So I really love, like, you know, true crime podcasts,
yeah,
and stuff like that. I'm like obsessed. I'm obsessed with murder mysteries, dark, horrible things. It's where my funny bone is. I can't explain it.
I think that's pretty cool.
Yeah. So that's me. I'm a really dark individual. And no, I don't have anything to promote. I want to thank you for asking me, and make sure that if there's some other question you have that you ask.
Okay. Yeah, definitely. Like I said, I'm fairly new to this. It's going pretty well. And I'm honored to have you on the show. So I might have missed something, but
sure.
If I have any questions, maybe we could do a part two at some point. Are you into that?
Absolutely. Sounds like a plan.
Okay. Well, Kira, I just want to tell you that it's been wonderful speaking with you, and I hope you have a great rest of the day. And I wanted to ask you one question. What kind of dog do you have? I'm a big dog guy.
I have three.
Okay.
I have three. They're all mutts, but they all are off-white. One is like a poodle mix. One is like a Bichon Frise mix. And one is a terrier mix. Two boys, one girl, all 20 pounds and under. And a handful, but very sweet.
What are their names, if you don't mind me asking?
No problem. Jim is our senior male. He's the 20 pounder. Madison's the girl. Her nickname's Stinky. She's the terrier mix. And then Hank is the newcomer. Hank is the Bichon mix. Hank is Mr. Trouble. And if anyone will bite you, it'll be Hank.
So since he's the one that will bite you, can I assume that maybe he's named after Henry?
No, it's funny. I thought you were going to say that he's my favorite.
I was taking it full circle back to what we were talking about.
I knew people would think that I named him after that, but no, the rescue had given him the name Hayden, and it was so sort of preppy and awful, but I was sort of trying to keep I was like, starts with the age, but a little more manly, more like Jim, Jim and I came up with Jim and Hank. I never called Henry Hank, so I've never thought of him that way. So no, it's nothing on him.
Okay. I just full circle. I was trying to bring him back. I didn't think it was. I just thought I'd bring that up. But, I tell you, Kira, this has been great. Thank you very, very much. I don't know. This has been an honor for me. So thank you. And I'll get a hold of you for part two at some time in the future.
All right. Please do. Have a great day.
You have a great day too. Thanks.
All right. Bye.
And there it was, my conversation with Kira Rossler, ex-bassist for Black Flag. I had a really good time speaking with Kira. We even got to talk about her dogs a little bit there at the end. I don't think she was too happy with me because I thought that she named her dog after Henry Rollins. But I had a really good time speaking with her. And I'm just really, really excited for the future. So if you guys made it this far, thank you for listening. And please come back next week. I don't have an interview set up as of now, but I have a couple of people that I know want to be on the show. So there will be a show next week. I'm not sure who the guest is going to be. I've got to narrow it down between a couple of people, but there will be a new show. So look for that next week. Like I said in the intro, I am, accepting some ads, some sponsorships if you guys are into doing it. So if you have a band and you want to get a little bit of promo going, I'll play your song. I'll talk about your band camp, like whatever you want me to do. Tour dates, just hit me up. We'll come to an agreement on a nominal fee, and we'll try to make it happen. Or if you have a product you'd like me to check out, we'll try to make that happen as well. So I don't want this thing to get like too many ads, but it'd be nice to make a little something off this, just so I don't have to keep putting money into it. So sorry if you are bored by me talking about the business side of things, but we'll see what happens. But so thank you once again for listening. I'm going to leave you with a song that is on Black Flag's album Slip It In. It's called The Bars. I picked this song because it starts out with Kira playing bass. And since Kira was the bass player, I kind of wanted to highlight something that, showed what she was doing in the band. So, here it is. I'm going to play it right now. It's by Black Flag. It's called The Bars, with an intro by Miss Kira Rossler of Black Flag. So thanks a lot, and we'll see you guys next week on That One Time on Tour.
your keeper. As once you get free, every time I see, I got my hand wrapped around the bar. I want out right now. She made an angel's flight on angel wings. Jumped out her apartment window and hit the street below. Every time I see, I got my hand wrapped around the bar. I can't shut off my mind. And now I'm waiting. My hands are wrapped around the bars. I'm burning. My soul is pushed against the bars. The bars, the lie, the lie, the lie, the lie, lie. The jail behind my eyes. My body hates my soul. I close my eyes and fight inside my own black hole. Every time I see, I got my hands up around the bar. I want out right now. I live my life. I'm doing my time. I realize life's live. Every time I see, wrapped around the bar, I can't shut off my mind. And now I'm waiting. My hands are wrapped around the bars. I'm burning. My soul is pushed against the bars. The bars, the lie, the lie, the lie, the lie, the lie, the prison behind my eyes.
Yes, we're out there, everyone. I'm Hal Schwartz.
And I'm Flynn McClain. Together, we host None But the Brave, a podcast dedicated to the music and career of Bruce Springsteen.
Bruce and E Street Band are on tour right now for the first time in 6 years, and we're taking a detailed look at what's happening on stage in our bi-weekly episodes.
We've also been recently joined by some very exciting guests, including rock journalist Warren Zanes and Stephen Hyden, Backstreet's magazine founder Charles Cross, and Barstool's Kirk Minahan.
If you're a diehard Springsteen fan, this is the show for you.
So please subscribe to None But the Brave on your favorite podcasting platform, and we hope to see you further on up the road.
Thank you so much! We'll be seeing you!